For the week of November 17th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 214, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And sniffling in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, I'm sorry you're sick.
Yeah, I've got a little run down, but I feel better today than yesterday, so hopefully I'll get through the show. I'll soldier on.
Well, you know, I'd love to say that we had time for me to tell you about how you could subscribe to our show in iTunes, Stitcher, the Microsoft Marketplace, or you could follow us on Twitter, at Showbiz Sandbox is our username, or the whole Facebook thing where you could like us because we have a page, Showbiz Sandbox. If you search for it, we have a page. I wish I could tell you these things, or that you could email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you could call us, 888-567-7263. I wish I could tell you all of this, Michael, but we have such a packed show today.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, one person that will not be emailing or calling us, of course, is Sid Field, the screenwriting guru who died apparently on Sunday.
Yes, and, you know, Sid Field was actually, he wrote a book called Screenplay in the, I want to say the 1980s, but he was on the board at Filmstew.com, which was a company I helped found in the late 1990s, and it's sad to see that he's passing. He not only wrote the you know, it was a best-selling book on screenwriting, but he was a screenwriting teacher, and the funny thing is, he had no screenwriting credits.
Right, right. It's a classic example. If you can't teach.
Yeah, if you can't do it, teach, yeah.
But some people are great at teaching other people how to do something well. That's always been a sort of a dismissive phrase, but you know, someone can be very good at analyzing someone else's screenplay, someone else's work, and helping them get better. It's a different skill set than actually writing something.
That's true. And now, speaking of teaching, that's kind of who we have on today's show, because I should say stick around all the way to the end, because we're going to be talking to Harvard Business School professor Anita Albersi, whose new book, Blockbusters, Hit-Making, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment, says if you want to make a lot of money in show business, go big. This past week also saw a lot of headlines having to do with movie ratings, and not just here in the United States, but overseas as well. Speaking of which, gun violence is not only increasing in modern-day society, but also in our movies. And I guess the question is, could the two be linked? We'll ask whether a well-known actress can be nominated for an acting Oscar simply for her vocal performance. We'll tell you how much money Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark has or hasn't made. I have to do that every time now, thanks to Karen Woodward. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Of course, we're talking about box office around the world, the worldwide box office. And the number one film is Thor: The Dark World, another $90 million this week. It dropped 50% from last week. That's not as meaningful when you're talking about worldwide box office. But last weekend, it made $180 million. And this weekend, it made $90 million. But of course, how you open up in different territories and all that makes that figure not the same. You got to really look territory by territory to see, you know, when that actually means something. But hey, it made a ton of money. $90 million is at $479 million worldwide. It's already passed a couple of the Avenger films worldwide box office and Thor's earlier take both in the North America and around the world. So it's a big, big success story. And it's not even remotely done yet.
$500 million almost, $500 million. And you're right, Michael, you can't really look at, well, you know, the film dropped 50% weekend to weekend, because in some territories, the film has been out already 3 weeks, and there may be holidays or certain reasons why exhibitors, movie theater owners, would take it off screen. There may be certain regulations where it has to come off screen. So you can't really track decrease.
And there are other territories where it hasn't opened yet. Right. So that sort of week by week thing where you say, it held pretty well. It only dropped 30%. You can do that when you're looking at a particular territory and know what's going on in that territory. But it will be a long time, if ever, before you can read anything meaningful into that worldwide. At number two around the world is the big news in North America. It's The Best Man Holiday. It grossed $30 million in its opening weekend. This is a sequel to a film that came out 14 years ago with a lot of talented young actors who've all gone on to very solid careers. And I don't know what took them so long, but they made the movie. It started a wave of what some people describe as aspirational black films starring handsome, attractive, talented people who are having successful careers. And The Best Man Holiday is a sequel to The Best Man, and it's done terrifically well its opening weekend. Always, always, when you have movies that star black actors or black themed, however you want to describe it, it seems like box office predictors always fall apart. They never get it right. They always underestimate how strongly the audience is going to come out to support these films. Whenever you see an estimate of how one of these movies is going to do on its opening weekend, add 30 or 40% and you'll be closer to what the truth is. That's what happened here. Everybody was blown away by how it did, but it's a very successful launch for that movie. Opened only in North America, it made $30 million. It's already going to be in the black with about a week.
You know what? Here's a little trivia note here. The film was directed by Malcolm Lee, who is related to who?
Spike?
That's correct. He is the brother of Spike Lee.
All right, here you go. Number three around the world is Gravity, another $24 million. It's at $514 million and counting. And number four, Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa, another $13 million. It's at $120 million worldwide. And number five, the Oscar hopeful Captain Phillips, starring Tom Hanks, another $13 million. It's at $164 million worldwide. And number six, Las Vegas, the old men go on a bachelor party trip to Vegas. Another $12 million. That's at $50 million and counting.
That's right. It's the hangover for senior citizens.
That's right. And number seven is The Counselor, the Ridley Scott film. It made $11 million. It's at $35 million worldwide. And number eight, the German comedy, Fuck You, Gotti. Apologize for that. What can I do? It seems to be doing really well. It had a great hold. It made another $11 million compared to about $10 or $12 or $13 million last week. And it's at $24 million and counting just in two territories. I assume that's Germany and, I don't know, Bavaria or something.
But now that you said that, we're going to be rated R. Thank you very much, Michael.
At number nine is, it's German. It's not what you think it means. At number nine is Escape Plan, Stallone and Schwarzenegger, another $10 million. That has passed the $100 million mark worldwide. At number 10, here's a film. It's called Friends 2. It made $9.5 million. It opened in one territory. And I spent a little while trying to figure out what this was, and I found a film from India, a Tamil film to be exact, called Friends, that came out in 2001. And I thought, is it a sequel to that? Turns out, no, it's actually a South Korean action film that's the sequel to a movie called Friend, which was also released in 2001, strangely enough. But they waited 13 years. But here's the sequel. It's about three friends who are in the gangland world, and it has a complicated structure, I think, from the 60s going back to the present day. So that's in South Korea, $9 million that made. And number 11 is Free Birds, another $9.5 million. That's at $50 million worldwide. At 12 is Ender's Game, another $8.4 million. That's at the $70 million mark. Definitely one of the year's big disappointments. At number 13 is Carrie. It's at $52 million and counting. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, part two, just jumped up to $200 million. The Italian film, Soli a Catanelli, that's at $58 million and counting. And then at the bottom of this list for the worldwide movies, it comes from Rent Track, is Hunger Games Catching Fire. It opened in Brazil. I don't know why, but it opened in Brazil a week early. It made $6.2 million. From what I can gather, it seems to have about doubled or tripled the box office it made on opening weekend for the first film. So a terrific early launch for The Hunger Games in Brazil. I don't know why they got it before everybody else, but more power to them.
I think there's a holiday. There are certain holiday reasons that's
done. Oh, there you go. Of course, that makes perfect sense.
Because it is summertime, you know, going into summertime in South America. So that would be part of the reason for doing that type of release.
That's right. So I don't know if or when The Hunger Games will be released in China.
Yeah, no, but, you know, before we move on, hey, you know what? I'm very disappointed this week in our box office, and here's why.
Why is that?
Oh, Turbo is not on the list, which means it didn't hit $300 million, and you will not have to first befriend a snail and then
eat one. Now you know that we can't rule that out. There may be another territory or two where it's waiting to come on.
That's true.
So the story is not over yet with Turbo. It is on the expanded list for Rent Track. It's way at the bottom. It's at the very bottom. It made $2.8 million. It's at $278 million and counting. So it needs another $22 million to pass the $300 million mark, at which point I must befriend and or eat a snail.
That's correct. Because you did not think that would ever happen. You know, speaking of things that I didn't think would ever happen is China, as you were trying to move us in that direction, China actually fighting pirates.
What?
Yes, and I don't mean the kind that are on the ocean. I mean the kind that are on the street corner with the latest hit movie or hit DVD or CD, selling them for a dollar.
They're getting basically very angry. Well, that's not really what they're fighting at the moment. What they're really fighting is the Google of China, which is called Baidu. And they're very upset that they link to websites where people can download unlicensed content. They can steal copies of movies. And they're saying, hey, why are you showing that stuff? Stop it. And they're seeking like $50 million in damages. A lot of people are suing them. And we'll have to see how successful they are.
Yeah, all these video websites are suing. And the MPAA was at this press conference where they kind of announced this lawsuit. And they said, we're going to be taking measures to stop Baidu and other search engines from hot linking. And that's really where you link to the pirated piece of content. And Google has tried to suppress this as well by putting it lower down in search results when you search for, I don't know, The Hunger Games, instead of it a pirated copy. Though it might be very popular as one of the links to go to, they don't want that appearing first. They want it appearing on page 50.
And that's been pretty effective?
That's been effective, yes. Although, you know, there are ways to get around that. And by get around that, I mean, if you really know how to pirate something and you want...
Right, but it's effective in the sense that most people do not find it or bother to go through whatever you're about to describe.
Correct.
Right. So that's interesting. They don't hide the information. They say, well, no, that's actually out there, but they do mess with the rankings so that they're not appearing on the first page and making it a lot easier for people to steal content.
Right. And they're suing for $40 million in damages.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know how much that is for Baidu. It sounds like Google would laugh at that amount. They're like, well, we'll pay that every month if you want.
Darn, we're going to have to eat in tonight. That's what they're going to say.
Right. So I wonder if China cares. They care about movies being pirated. Do they care about movies being violent? Certainly The Hunger Games is controversial to a degree. You've got kids killing kids. That's what the whole film was about.
Yes. Yes. And that's why we said last week that a theme park around Hunger Games, probably not such a smart idea.
Right. And of course, they have a lot of bows and arrows, among other weapons in
right.
The Hunger Games, at least Katniss. That's her weapon of choice. But one new study suggests that maybe gun violence in American movies is rising.
Yeah. And this was a study that was published in the December issue of Pediatrics. And it was then, you know, there were news stories in the New York Times, LA Times, Variety. There were all these stories and it was on CNN about how the level of gun violence in the hit PG-13 movies, so not PG-13 movies that nobody goes to see, but kind of well-viewed or much-viewed PG-13 movies, has been rising, and it actually now, gun violence that is, now exceeds the gun violence that is in R-rated films.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all, because we've always been more tolerant in America of violence rather than sex. So a movie gets an R rating if you use the F word. It gets an R rating if you show people having sex or frontal nudity. But it can be a PG-13 movie if you're blasting away at people.
Yes.
And so I don't see why this has gotten such traction. I'm also not quite sure how the study was done. It was a little, Sperling got a copy of it. He's going to check it out. It was a little confusing. It said it looked at movies from the 1950s to the present, to which point you say, well, wait a second, they didn't have the ratings until, what was it, the 70s?
I want to say 1966, 68, somewhere in there.
Okay, that's when they started rating. So why did you go back to the 50s? And it certainly didn't have the PG-13 until Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, I believe. That was the movie they created.
Yeah, 1984 to 86 is when that kind of...
That's when that was created specifically for Spielberg in a way, because there was more violence, but they didn't want to give it an R. And so suddenly there you had the PG-13. So they seem to be comparing apples to oranges, going back a lot farther than they should. But the ultimate takeaway is we don't care as much about violence as we do about sex. We knew that already.
Yeah, but do you think it's linked to increased gun violence in society and in specifically North America?
Well, my brother says yes. He says, if you don't think movies and TV shows influence kids, watch my sons after watching a Batman TV episode where they immediately turn around and start beating the heck out of each other. He says you'll have no doubts.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I walked in to my home, and there were my two daughters, 8 and 7 years old, watching Tomb Raider, which really is an innocuous, I mean, there's no cursing. I don't believe there's any cursing or foul language, but it's just loaded with gun violence. And
oh, yeah.
There is Angelina Jolie, an empowered woman. And that's what really they like about it, is there's a woman, a girl, running around in her tight outfit, shooting.
She'd be more empowered if she didn't look like a porn star.
Well,
you know, come on. She's as curvy and bootylicious, and her breasts are going to make her tip over. I mean, the Tomb Raider Lara Croft and Angelina Jolie as portrayed by her isn't so much empowered as a male fantasy of an empowered woman.
But they're 8 and 6. I'm not really going to get into that with them.
Well, that's body image and things that you should, you know, it's like if you want to choose what you're going to expose them to, you can have empowered women who are not firing guns and don't look like porn stars.
Right. Well, and that's
just
kind
a
of
thought.
Let's put it this way. I did not put this movie on for them.
I'm not saying you're a bad father.
Other than the fact that you're a bad father. But I walk in on this scene and she's literally got two guns and, you know, on both hands and she's like firing up the play. And I'm just like, really? When you walk in on this, this does not look good.
Well, at least she wasn't kissing a woman.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, if you're in South Korea, that can be a problem for a movie. They just had a Supreme Court ruling about a rating for a gay film, a gay short film, I should say, called Just Friends, with a question mark. It's a 30-minute romantic comedy about a young gay couple in their 20s. It was being released in 2009, and it got a restricted 15 and over rating because there was a kiss scene. And a heavy kissing between two men. And they thought it was hazardous for teenagers due to body exposure, as well as detailed and direct portrayals of sexual encounters. More specifically, sexual encounters between two kids, two men. And the filmmaker appealed it, and it's gone all the way through the court system, all the way up to the Supreme Court, which has now just ruled that, in fact, this rating was discriminatory against the film simply because it was a gay film. And they felt that it would harm human rights and threaten the human rights of the LGBT community. And they overturned the conservative rating to make it eligible for all teenagers to see this short film. Not that they'd be rushing out to see a short film. But the guy who did this is called Kim Yo. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his name. Kim Jo. I'm not sure how to say his name. J-H-O. But he also just took part in the country's first public gay wedding ceremony with the CEO of a gay production distribution company called Rainbow Factory. Appropriately enough.
Right. Well,
so he's just breaking down barriers left and right.
Yeah. Well, and of course, now all South Korean teenagers will race out and have same sex marriages.
That's right. But they, as long as they don't curse.
Yes. Well, because again, and I think I may have said this last week, that the appeals board, which is this secret board that you go before if you're trying to appeal a rating that Kara or the MPAA has given your film here in the United States, you go before an appeals board. They did a study which said that parents are more concerned with actions on film that their children can leave a movie theater and then immediately imitate or mimic. So cursing is something that is, you know, they want to protect their kids.
So they're more worried about a child cursing or kissing than they are by blowing up a bomb because they don't have easy access to a bomb.
Right. They think that's more cartoonish in a way. That there's no way that could actually happen unless you live in Colorado, apparently.
And the result is that you have a Judi Dench film called Philomena. It's directed by Stephen Frears. It's going to be coming out soon, and she's a hopeful contender for Best Actress. It's about a woman trying to track down the daughter, their child, I should say the son, rather, that she was forced to give up for adoption 50 years earlier. That's the film. Clearly not a button-pushing, you know, edgy, pushing the envelope type movie. It's an Oscar hopeful with Judi Dench as the star, but somebody in the movie, a journalist played by Steve Coogan, says the F word couple times.
He says
and
it
so
twice.
Automatically you get an R rating.
Right. He says it twice. I did see the film. I saw it at the AFI Film Festival, which was here in town last week. And I have to say, you know, it's great to be last because they get to show all the really good Oscar potential films at the end of the year. And they have the entire year's worth of film festivals to choose from. And it's a fun film festival. I saw this film and he does. Steve Coogan, who wrote the film, uses the F-bomb twice. And he said
that means it's an automatic R.
That's right. Well, that's not an official rule, but it's kind of an official unwritten rule. And he says, when my character uses profanity in Philomena, it reflects badly on his character. Yes, it does. I question whether it needed to be used at all in one instance, but I kind of understand why he was trying to use that.
But who cares whether it makes his character look good or bad? It's just an F word. If he said it 100 times in a movie, okay. But like twice, a journalist says it twice in a movie that they want a PG-13 rating for, you know, children over teenagers. This is something that they have to be scared about. They might hear the F word twice. You know, but luckily they appealed. They won the appeal. It got moved down from an R rating to a PG-13. So it will come out as a PG-13 movie. Here's what I find hilarious. They say, oh, the movie has a strong message about faith and forgiveness. And the Weinsteins are planning to hopefully appeal to religious moviegoers. So they really wanted to get a PG-13 rating so that it wouldn't turn off those people. You know, an R rating might tell them, oh, this is too adult. I don't want to see this. You know, it's maybe a film with content I don't like. So that it was very important to them that they get a PG-13 rating so they could reach out to these groups, religious groups, and people that would perhaps be interested in the film. To which I say, well, if you really want to reach religious moviegoers, taking out the F word would help even more.
That's true.
Yeah, y'all, we really want to reach them with the PG-13. Guess what? You'll reach them even better if you take out two gratuitous uses of the word, you know, F.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. The movie, you know, the woman's character starts
off... What's the name of that German film? Back you go to... Anyway, sorry.
Yes. The woman starts off, Judi Dench's character starts off as a teenager who has, you know, has a child out of wedlock.
What an actress.
Yeah, and she is...
Well, I mean, really, wow, amazing. She starts off playing a teenager?
Well, it was an actress.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And she's at a convent, and the sisters basically, you know, they keep her enslaved. And this was the Madeleine, the time...
She was a Madeleine girl.
Yeah, in Ireland, yeah.
Oh, heavens. Oh, yeah.
So, yes, I mean, this is not a prime moment or a lovely moment in Catholic history. So if you really want, you know, religious moviegoers or, you know, church-going moviegoers to show up, probably don't make a movie about this because...
Madeleine. Yes, that's, again, so that's what the movie's about, a woman who was trapped in the Madeleine laundries and yes. had to give up her child and now is trying to find it 50 years later and you think, oh, we're going to get all the Catholics to go.
Yeah. Especially, I'm not going to give anything away, but especially once, well, see the movie. It's actually worth seeing. I don't think any teenager in their right mind would actually want to go see this movie.
Exactly. So, you know, the whole point of it is silly, you know. An R rating wouldn't hurt it because no teens are going to it, but an R rating for two uses of the F word seems a little silly to me. But she will be a contender for Best Actress, as is potentially, maybe, possibly, for the first time ever, an actress giving just a voice performance, meaning a voice performance as in an animated film, or in this case, the movie Her, starring Scarlett Johansson.
Yes, now this was another film I saw at the AFI Film Festival, and this
La-di-da.
This is a great movie. This is a movie really? by Spike Jonze.
One of your best of the year?
It was. I think it probably will. I would like to see it again, actually, because it did have this disembodied Scarlett Johansson voice. And when she first appears on screen, or not on screen.
It's a movie about Joaquin Phoenix falling in love with the voice of his computer, kind of like falling in love with Siri on the iPhone.
Right, and it's set in the near future, so the Los Angeles that's presented is this kind of like realistic yet not realistic Los Angeles, and it was very interesting. I mean, you know, he's going through a divorce, and he's trying to overcome his feelings about the divorce, and Scarlett Johansson's character is this artificial intelligence that begins to question, well, why don't I have a body? Why do I feel these emotions? And
would you give her an Oscar nomination? Do you think it's one of the five best performances of the year?
Oh, brother. It's a good performance. It is a good performance. Maybe a supporting actress nomination? Just to kind of... I'd have to kind of go through in my mind who all the other actresses would be to see if she would be up there.
Either you think she's worthy or not. It doesn't mean you're choosing her among the five, but you think she's perhaps more of a best supporting actress than a lead actress? The character's not in the movie that much?
She is in the movie quite a bit, but it's really, Joaquin Phoenix is almost a shoo-in for best actor because he's literally acting with himself.
Uh-huh.
He's acting against this voice that's in his ear that he can hear, and he winds up having literally a relationship with this artificial intelligence, with this operating system.
I wonder if it will hurt her that she replaced Samantha Morton, who was cast in the role. That's why the character is called Samantha. And apparently at some point they decided they didn't like her voice or weren't happy with it, and they replaced her with Scarlett Johansson.
Yes. Well, but, you know, this has been a question for some time now, whether you're Andy Serkis or Scarlett Johansson or Zoe Saldana, these performances where...
Zoe Saldana has never given an Oscar-worthy performance.
I'm just saying where the actor or actress is there and their performance is there, but they're not. Their body isn't because it's motion capture.
It's not a question. Actually, with Andy Serkis, his body is there because he's being filmed and giving the physical performance of the character, even though Gollum or the ape from Rise of the Planet of the Apes or whatever is being changed, but he is actually giving the physical performance as well. It's absurd that he wouldn't be considered it. But, I mean, you're in an animated film, Robin Williams, Best Supporting Actor for Aladdin? Absolutely. Why not a nomination? I would say it was the best thing in the film.
Yes.
I don't think there's any question that a great voice performance is worthy of an Oscar, a nomination, or a win, just like a great performance where you're on screen. Why not?
Well, you know, here's a little weird hiccup here, or not hiccup, but something I noticed. So Sofia Coppola, and Spike Jonze, the director of this film, were married. And they were married when she made Lost in Translation, and Giovanni Ribisi played a film director in Lost in Translation that many believe was meant to represent Spike Jonze and how that their relationship, the relationship of Scarlett Johansson and Giovanni Ribisi, was dissolving, kind of like the relationship of Sofia Coppola and Spike Jonze, and it was meant to mirror each other. So Scarlett Johansson starred in that film, kind of replacing Sofia Coppola. Now you have Spike Jonze, Sofia Coppola's ex-husband, making a film kind of discussing, you know, a divorce, kind of referencing his own divorce from Sofia Coppola, using the same exact actress, Scarlett Johansson.
Well, it's not a biographical film, is it?
No, not at all. Not at all. I just think it's I don't know, ironic, maybe.
Well, all right.
Or you just don't like my kind of bringing in all this personal stuff, making it into a soap opera.
Exactly. I could care less.
Most people could care less about soap operas these days, except that is if you
No, because they're actually, you know, now that there are only about a few handful, four soaps left on the air, they've actually been picking up viewers and doing pretty well. And the networks are sort of going, hey, look at that. There's still life left. It looked like they were going to be gone any minute now from the networks. But now that there's just four soaps on network television, you know, like one or two for each network, they're doing pretty darn good competing with the chat shows and the cheaper things like The Chew and The View. And they're going to be around for a while now. So that's good news. But there is a big fight about trying to take them online.
I mean, we talked about this in the past.
Absolutely.
I mean, Prospect Park was the name of the company. And they wanted to keep soaps alive, but online. And they struggled to try and get their kind of online network up. And they had to scale back all of their plans. And by the way, Oprah kind of talked about enjoying the shows enough to rerun them on her network, OWN.
Well, it's funny. It was the online shows that got rerun on Oprah's own network like a week later or something like that.
Yeah, well, now they're suing ABC, claiming the network blocked them at every turn, and now details are actually coming out in court. When these cases go to trial, that's when all these documents get published and we get the juicy tidbits.
Yeah, this is when the fun begins. I mean, this is all per Prospect Park. They've lost something like they paid like $30 million for the rights to the shows and to launch the online versions, which stumbled almost from the start. You know, they announced bigger plans, scaled back the number of episodes, had to scale back the number of weeks that they, I mean, it was just, it never got off the ground, really. But they claim there's a really good reason because ABC fought them every step of the way. They say as soon as they sold them, then ABC regretted its decision to sell off the rights to One Life to Live and All My Children and decided to block Prospect Park. Whether they wanted to bring them back to the network or what or why, I don't know, but that's what Prospect Park claims. They say ABC wanted to create a mega soap.
Oh, I see.
General
they combine,
Hospital.
Yeah, they combine
and bring
all the characters.
All the top people from One Life to Live and all the top people from All My Children. Hey, let's get Susan Lucci, put her on General Hospital. You know, we got 30 years of fandom for her. Why throw her away? Let's put her on General Hospital. We got that show left. Let's put them on there. That was the plan.
That was actually, that would have been a good idea. Now, I have to say, when I go to the doctor, there's a television in the waiting room and soap operas are on. I have no idea why soap operas are on that television at the doctor's office. But every time I watch these soap operas thinking, who watches these things? These things are awful.
Well, there are good actors who come out of them. A lot of good actors, you know, everyone from Sarah Michelle Gellar to
Ming-Na came out of soap operas.
Endless number of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a good training ground. It's fun. It's silly. It's light. It's just something you can watch and turn off your mind for a little bit. But, you know, the soap opera behind the scenes here is even more interesting. Here's what Prospect Park claims. They say ABC tricked Prospect Park, and this is true, that they did allow ABC to continue to use some One Life to Live characters on General Hospital. But what happened was, as they complained earlier, the ABC put these people on General Hospital and immediately killed some off and then took others and embedded them so deeply into the storylines of General Hospital that it would be almost impossible to pull them out again and start them fresh on One Life to Live. You know, they tied them up with everything that was going on. So fans who were following them were like, oh, okay, now she's dating him. What? You know, they would just get angry if you pulled them off GH and then put them online and tried to reboot it yet again. And they say that was all a plot to try and frustrate Prospect Park and allow ABC to keep these characters and use them on their show. They also say ABC signed secret multi-year deals with key actors so they wouldn't be available to work on Prospect's online versions. So they lost $30 million, and now they're suing for $95 million in damages for expenses and lost profits. So, you know, will it get to trial? We'll have to see. If there's a lot of dirt, maybe ABC will pony up. Sounds like a disaster all around.
Yeah, I think in the end, this will be settled out of court.
Well, do you? I mean, that's a lot of money. And if ABC says, well, we didn't do anything wrong, you bought it and you failed, why are we going to pay you off for having failed? Why would they do that? Why would they hand over $50 million just to make them go away?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, you know, you wanted to buy it. You wanted to launch online versions. You failed. And now I'm supposed to pay you $50 million so you don't lose any money?
Yeah,
you know,
let's
remember, this is all from the point of view of Prospect Park, not ABC.
True. Let's get ABC on the phone. I want to find out what their side is. Just call me Judge, by the way, or Your Honor, either way.
Well, that's a soap opera in and of itself, but you can always, I'm excited because I'm going to the theater all this week. I've been feeling a little ill, and so I really rested up today and hopefully tomorrow so I can be ready. I've got great theater Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night. I'm really excited, starting with two plays by Mark Rylance and repertoire tonight and tomorrow night. So hopefully I'll feel well enough. But the theater is always exciting for me. And there's some really good news for theater lovers. Shakespeare in Love is coming to the West End. The Oscar-winning film Shakespeare in Love, which is Steven Spielberg's least favorite movie of all time.
Are you serious? He actually said that?
No, but I mean, he lost out for Best Picture thanks to Shakespeare in Love, right?
Oh,
for saying Private Ryan,
right.
Lost out. He could have gotten his second Best Picture Oscar after Schindler's List.
That's right.
But so he, you know, it's coming to
he
the stage.
He did win Best Director for that, though.
He did for Schindler's List.
Yeah, and he won Best Director for Saving Private Ryan. So, yeah.
That's right, but he lost Best Picture. He really won. It was a come-from-behind victory for the little kid Shakespeare in Love. And it's a Valentine to the theater, of course. It's got a young Will Shakespeare. He's penniless. He's broke. He's desperate for a hit when he becomes enamored with a noble woman playing a man so she can act in a play, because it was against the rules at the time for a woman to perform on stage. And so Gwyneth Paltrow disguised herself as a man so she could act. And he became inspired by her, and the result was Romeo and Juliet, the greatest romance of all time, and his career never looked back. So Disney Theatrical, which is a very big powerhouse, of course, in theater now, they're bringing the show to the stage, got a really strong team behind it. One of the first people I ever wrote about in New York in theater was Cheek by Jowl, this great British theater company. And the director of that is, Declan Donnellan, and he's directing the stage production. His partner, Nick Ormerod, is doing the design work. They always work together. So they are directing and designing the show. Lee Hall, who won a Tony for his Billy Elliot adaptation of his own screenplay, is adapting the screenplay written for the movie by Tom Stoppard and Mark Norman. That's a lot of names in there, but it's a lot of talent. Lee Hall, Cheek by Jowl, Shakespeare in Love, Disney Theatrical. It's going to start next July in London, and it's got great name recognition. It's a very fun story. We'll have to see if they pull it off on stage.
Well, you know who also works together a lot on Broadway is Julia Houston and Tom Levitt.
Okay, who are they?
Those were the characters played by Deborah Messing and Christian Borle in Smash.
Oh, okay.
Right? I mean, they were working together. They had a long history together.
Okay.
Okay, granted, that was more of a soap opera, but...
Absolutely. But I know there's another stage production you're looking forward to.
That's right. I'm actually looking forward to William Goldman working with Disney, of all people, on The Princess Bride, a stage version of The Princess Bride. Now, there's no writer, no director, there's nothing really. It's more of, what do they call those things in Hollywood where you, an idea. They had an idea.
William Goldman had been working with Adam Gattell, who's a terrific composer, to create a musical version of The Princess Bride, but that did not bear fruit. And now he's teaming up with Disney, so... You know, maybe they'll find out the right way to it. You know, it was going to be a musical. Now they're going to decide again whether it should be a musical or a stage comedy or play, what they're going to do. But it's obviously, again, a beloved property, a great novel, very fun movie. They love the name recognition like that. If you're going to spend $10 to $50 million on a stage production, it's nice to have the safety net of knowing there's a big audience there waiting to see it. That was certainly the thinking behind Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. I did a little more digging in, because I've been saying, you know, as soon as the show announces it's closing, which is going to happen any day now.
Wait, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. Don't you mean Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark?
That's right. Any day now, they're going to have to announce the show's closing. It's been losing money every week since mid-August. There's no point in keeping it open anymore. It's run for just about 3 years. And people are going to say what a horrible, terrible flop it is. And that's true financially. But I did some figures. I basically said, all right, it costs $1 million a week to run. And I went from the beginning to today, and if it made more than a million, I added it up. If it made less than a million, I subtracted. And I found out that over 2.5 years, it had netted $50 million in profits. To be specific, $49.3 million in profits all the way up to mid-August of this year. So it cost $75 million to produce, but they had chipped away at two-thirds of that. Now, that still means they'd have to run another year and a half making money just to break even. So clearly a disaster financially from that point of view. But hey, they ran 2.5 years, made money every week, almost every week, grossed $50 million above their operating costs. So they were chipping away at it. So that's just not a horrible flop the way you would describe some other shows like Big Fish, which opened and shut in 10 weeks and lost $14 million. It's probably already all gone down the till. But it ran for 3 years. It has an audience. Maybe they can pull off their touring thing. And if they do their touring plan, which is to play in bigger arenas like Madison Square Garden, maybe they can actually end up in the black. You know, it's possible. They've made $50 million on Broadway. If they can make another $25, $30, $40 million on the road, the cost of taking it on the road may actually prove worthwhile.
Yeah, I know that if it came to Los Angeles, I would go see it.
Well, I wouldn't recommend it because it's terrible.
Right. And everybody I know who's seen it has said, what did you just say about it?
Terrible.
Yeah, that's pretty much the adjective used to describe Spider-Man. Turn off the dark.
That's right. But you feel lucky because you got your ticket for Bette Midler. She's coming to L.A. in that one-woman show about Sue Mengers, the famed Hollywood agent. And you got your ticket.
That's right. I'll Eat You Last was the...
Evans. Yes. That's right. But you were lucky to buy it when you did, weren't you?
Yes, I guess I bought it for $87, which at the Geffen Playhouse, it's a very small theater. I thought, my God, that's a lot of money for the Geffen Playhouse, but apparently not a whole heck of a lot of money compared to what people are now paying, which is $400. That's a lot.
Where's your seat?
My seat is in the orchestra, but in the back of the orchestra. But so it's maybe like, 25, 30 rows back, maybe.
Huh. You'll see Bette Midler far away. Little glasses, and you can see her pretty well.
No, trust me, this is a very small theater. It's fine sitting there. That's why I said, you know what? I'll take the $87 seats, because the other tickets were like $200 for like sitting in the center of the orchestra, and I thought, forget it.
Well, I would say that is truer for a musical, but for a one-person show, I'd rather be a lot closer, I think. But I'm excited that you're going to see it. Well, I'm not excited, because I was very mixed on the show, though I thought she was fun. But when is that happening?
I don't know. Sometime in December.
All right. So that'll be a big deal. A little holiday treat for you two.
Yes, it is a big deal, which means it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about The Simpsons. You might remember them. They've been around for about, 25 years, actually. Actually, 26 years if you count this year. Because in a landmark deal that could actually be the wave of the future, reruns of The Simpsons have been sold to Fox's sister company FXX. Get it? FXX?
I got it.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's going to start in the fall of 2014. FXX will own the rights to syndicate the first 25 seasons of the animated show, just as the 26th season begins to air on Fox. Plus, they have the right to get future seasons. The episodes available already number more than 500. More importantly, they've quote-unquote future-proofed the deal, as one exec put it. FXX will also have the quote-unquote non-linear rights, and that's not, I shouldn't say quote-unquote non-linear, that's the term for these. These are rights to reruns...
streaming online.
Yeah, the FXX
app. On demand.
Yeah, they have this app called FXX Now, and if you want to stream the show, really, you're going to have to go to FXX. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal, not because they bought the rerun rights for their channel, but the fact that they packaged it with the right to have the streaming online on-demand version available as well. I'm not a big fan of having to go to a million different sites to try and remember, now I like MASH. Where do I go to find MASH? Where do I go to find Cheers? Where do I go to find, Gunsmoke? Where do I go to find The Simpsons? To me, it gets a little confusing. But, if you know that FXX is the home of The Simpsons, and you get their app, then you can watch reruns of the show online. And I think in the future, when people are paying big money for a syndicated series like this, why wouldn't you want the on-demand version as well? Unless you're not set up for that. It just seems like something that you got to have, right? Otherwise, you're paying for reruns on TV when people are watching it online and you're losing out.
Much like The Princess Bride and it being sent to Broadway by Disney, guess who the head of Disney is? Alan Horn. He was the head of Castle Rock when The Princess Bride was made. Now, why am I mentioning this? Why am I going backwards to talk about a story we just finished? Because Castle Rock produced The Princess Bride, and now he's bringing it to Disney to bring to Broadway. Guess what? FX or FXX is a property of 20th Century Fox or 21st Century Fox, whatever the News Corp is now calling themselves these days. So they're selling the show to themselves.
Princess Bride is not being sold to the same company.
Yes, true.
It's a guy who has a history with it, who's bringing it to his new company.
Right. It's all very incestuous.
That's a little different. But yes, you're right. FXX is buying it from its own company, and they get in lots of trouble with that when they don't, the X-Files and lots of shows have sued when the network has sold itself to its own cable channel, and they feel like, oh, they didn't get a great deal for it. We feel like we're getting cheated out of profits so that you can just keep it cheaper for yourself. In this case, they said they sold set it for a record amount of money for the syndication deal for all these 500-plus episodes and the online streaming rights. Presumably, Matt Groening has signed off. He's got the power to make sure he's happy with it.
Yeah, what you're talking about is David Duchovny suing Fox for...
One of many examples.
Yeah, where I guess Fox sold it to themselves.
When a studio sells a TV show to its own channel for reruns, the people involved creatively who are going to get a piece of the pie want to make sure they got the full product, because it's to the studio's advantage to sell it really cheaply so the cable channel can benefit from a cheap reruns of a popular show. It's to the creative people's advantage to sell it for expensive amount because that's when they make their money. So it's a conflict of interest.
Well, this next story actually interested me. Longtime U2 manager Paul McGinnis is stepping away from day-to-day activities, but don't worry. The band told him, we'll continue with or without you. Get it? See what I did there?
I got it.
Okay. Both U2's and Madonna's management firms are being bought by Live Nation, with Madonna's Gaio series stepping in on day-to-day activities for the band. In a statement, McGinnis said, as I approach the musically relevant age of 64, I have resolved to take a less hands-on role as the band embarks on the next cycle of their extraordinary career. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. The rock band manager retires. I like the fact that he makes a little Beatles reference there, the musically relevant age of 64.
That's right.
I'm sure Madonna had to sign off on this, though, because she's a full-time job. She has massive world tours. That's why Gaio Siri is capable of taking on U2. But boy, balancing those two major superstar acts, you want to say to one of them, hey, could you release your album in 2015? Because the other one has an album coming out in 2014. So that's
although they're not mutually exclusive.
They're not. But if you don't want both their tours and albums coming out at the same time, that's all.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, no, they're not. Commercially, they don't compete with each other. But for his time and talent in launching a tour and an album and that massive 2-3 year campaign that is, that's definite overlap. So I'm sure, challenging.
Well, and I'm sure that many people would say, listening to what you just said, well, they have people who can do that. But the reality is, every time I saw U2 in a position where I was actually working on something that they were working on a tour or where I was backstage, there was Paul McGinnis. He was at every show, every time I was there. Even in Cannes, when they showed up to do their 3D film there,
he was there.
These guys on these big acts, they travel with the band.
That's your career, yeah. I mean, that's been his career nonstop. So it's quite a change to have somebody who's on the other line with somebody else.
Exactly.
So we'll see how that works out.
Speaking of other big superstars, Eminem topped the Billboard album charts last week, selling almost 800,000 copies of the Marshall Mathers LP 2, a sequel.
A blockbuster sequel.
Exactly. He was second only to Justin Timberlake for the top debut of the year. Two very interesting telling details, though. One, the album was available for streaming on Spotify and was streamed to some 10 million people, or at least it was streamed 10 million times. Some say this shows streaming helps sales, either by word of mouth to people who don't subscribe to Spotify, or by somehow those people choosing to also purchase the album. Or you could say the demand was so high that he might have sold 1 million copies or more if it hadn't been so widely and legally available for listening. That's one way of looking at it. The second interesting detail, the number two album of the week was the new CD by Celine Dion. Get this, it sold 77,000 copies. And no, we did not accidentally drop a zero in that number. So 800,000 gets you first place, 77,000 gets you second place. Big deal or big whoop?
That's a big deal for both reasons. And I think it's going to tie in nicely into our interview with the Harvard professor about blockbusters, because Eminem's album is clearly a blockbuster and all the others are also rans. My goodness, Celine Dion is one of the best-selling acts of all time. A couple hundred million copies of albums she has sold. To have her album debut at number two would be fine, but to sell 77,000 copies, that is very, very weak start. Eminem, I'm fascinated about what you think about whether the streaming helps or hurt it.
Well, I can tell you this much. Sitting on my desk right now, and I am a proud, satisfied customer of Spotify. And I use RDO and Pandora and everything else. Sitting on my desk, I have, all purchased by myself, a Pearl Jam album, the latest Pearl Jam album, which I can stream on Spotify, and I paid for it, paid for the album. I have the Arcade Fire release, Reflector, which I could stream on Spotify, and did stream on Spotify, and I paid for it. And an album by San Fermin, a young band, a new band coming out of Brooklyn, Michael. They were mentioned on NPR and on Pitchfork, and the very good album. I could stream it on Spotify, but instead, I paid for it. Why? Because these are bands that I would like to support, and I know that buying their album supports them. It tells the record company, hey, keep investing in this act. I like them.
Well, that's anecdotal, of course. I wonder what you think overall, whether most people, whether that 10 million streaming means they probably lost 500,000 sales, or whether 10 million streaming means they're just helping get the word out to everybody.
I think it helps get the word out. I also think that people who, I don't think they lost many sales at all. I think, if anything, it's helping. It's raising the awareness, and we are still in our society, we still want to own the media. Now, that may change
the kids,
going forward.
Your kids won't think that.
That is correct. I completely agree. That may change.
So that is the number one album. He has the number two single, The Monster, Eminem featuring Rihanna from the Marshall Mathers LP 2. And of course, that is a blockbuster album. It's a sequel to a blockbuster. I forget how much Marshall Mathers sold. It was meant to be like 8 million copies, 10 million copies in the U.S. I mean, it was a massive selling album. But I just looked up because we got breaking news. As we look, we just got the figures on Spider-Man. It lost another $250,000 last week.
Wow, I'm not going to go to any one of those producers and ask for a loan.
It sold 21 million copies worldwide, Eminem has, for the Marshall Mathers LP. So we'll have to see how well the sequel does.
You're giving our listeners whiplash. You're going back and forth.
Sorry about that.
Well, let's talk about Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, because what do you do if your lead actor has a substance abuse problem? According to The Hollywood Reporter, when it comes to actor Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and the TV series Dracula, you hold back most of his salary until shooting is complete. That's what they did for the Budapest set shooting of 10 episodes of the Dracula reboot. Rhys-Meyers.
Boy, is that hard to say fast. Budapest set shooting.
Yeah, well, it was set in Budapest. Rhys-Meyers had substance abuse problems on his last TV show, The Tudors, which was why NBC exec Bob Greenblatt, who, by the way, had worked with the actor on that Showtime series and courted him for this new series, Dracula, he went with the delayed payment approach. Rhys-Meyers got a per diem and other amounts, but the bulk of his $100,000 per episode salary wasn't handed over until the shoot ended.
I guess the idea is if he goes on a bender, it can happen once it's all over.
I don't know.
By the way, $100,000 per episode. I still don't understand why you would sign a movie deal for 50 Shades of Grey for $100,000. Anyway.
Well, did this approach help? Per The Hollywood Reporter, according to sources, the star's problems recurred while filming during Dracula. And then following the filming, he had a meltdown. He returned to London and quietly was hospitalized for a short time. Nonetheless, all 10 episodes of the Cole Haddon-created series have been delivered. Sources say Rhys-Meyers, who required a sober companion to accompany him on set, returned to rehab as soon as filming was completed.
You know, they stopped filming, and he had a meltdown, and he went to London and was hospitalized for a short time.
Okay.
Then he went back and finished the season. So, you know, could it have been worse if they'd given him money? I don't know. I say it's a big whoop, of course, in the scheme of things. It's interesting as far as how it shows how Hollywood does deal with people, because there are a lot of times where actors with troubled histories, you want to work with them, or you think you should work with them, and you want to do what's safest for you and for them. And this is one thing that they apparently have done, at least in his case. I wonder if Charlie Sheen gets paid all his money, or they have to wait till anger management's done. Who knows? But why did this come out now, I wonder, and how?
I have no idea.
Sort of this out-of-nowhere story that suddenly came out saying, yeah, Rhys-Meyers had this, you know, substance abuse problem on Tudors. It re-showed itself on Dracula. And this NBC had tried to deal with it by doing this delayed payment thing. It sort of helped, I guess, because, I mean, he came back and he finished the film. But, you know, who knows what's going on
there. Well, is this a series? Is there going to be another?
There won't, because it's doing very poorly. It is a series, but it's on Friday nights following Grimm, and it's doing very poorly. So it will not be renewed.
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, normally, if this kind of stuff comes out, there are reasons for it. And one reason could be, oh, well, we're trying to negotiate a better deal with the lead actor, so we're going to put this out there, and it'll make him have to, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why stuff like this comes out.
Mm-hmm. None of them nice.
Yes.
None of them because they think this guy needs help. Let's help him by
that's right.
having an intervention via the Hollywood Reporter.
Well, and quite honestly, it becomes almost impossible to ensure productions with cast members with substance abuse problems. It is a disease. It is an addiction. And so it's very, very difficult.
Yeah, he had to leave the show for a few days at least. So that's very scary if you're providing the insurance.
Precisely. Star Wars can't catch a break, but the spanky, spanky love story known as 50 Shades of Grey is bowing to reality. After a last-minute cast change for its male lead, they pushed the production start date to December and had a release scheduled for August of 2014, just 8 months later. That's not a good idea. This wasn't wise. So instead, they've got their eye on Valentine's Day. Now the film will be coming out on February 13th of 2015, just in time for a naughty Valentine's Day, Michael. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. Pushing a release date is no big deal. It doesn't mean anything. It's hilarious that this movie is getting treated better than the Star Wars movies.
it can be because it's a smaller bet, so to speak. There's less money going into it, but still, it is a tentpole for them.
It's a real potential big hit. And I noticed that the Valentine's Day film of 2014 is Endless Love, which looks like a dreadful remake of a dreadful film starring Brooke Shields, which is based on a great novel by Scott Spencer. It's probably in bookstores again because of the movie. If you have any interest at all in a really great book, read Scott Spencer's novel, Endless Love, to see how great that book is. The movies that are being made from it have nothing to do with the book as far as its terrific literary value. Just a great, great novel.
People do a lot of things on the internet. They do. They do a lot of things on the internet. Let's just put it that way. But because streaming and downloading video takes up so much bandwidth, it looks like people don't do anything else. On Bloomberg, an analysis of September internet traffic by Sandvine shows YouTube and Netflix accounted for 50% of all downstream traffic. That is, all the stuff people pull from the internet and load onto their computer or stream to their computer. That's not just in prime time, by the way. That's all day long. Netflix is down a tad to 32% of traffic, while YouTube is up to 18% or so. So YouTube gaining ground there. Way, way back is Amazon at 1.6% and Hulu behind them at 1.29%. Both are down from last year at this time. File sharing is also way down. BitTorrent has dropped from 10% to 7%, and file sharing as a whole dropped from 31% to less than 10% today. Let me get this straight. More legal content available in more ways than ever before at reasonable prices equals less piracy. Who would have guessed? Oh, right. We did. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It still seems like they're sucking up a lot of bandwidth on the internet. I don't know if I should read too much into this being just downstream traffic versus upstream traffic or what. I know there's a lot. You need a lot more bandwidth for pulling stuff onto your computer than for sending out questions or whatever to the internet or searching websites. But it sounds like they're still eating up a lot of bandwidth. Is that right, Sperling?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, basically you have upstream traffic, which is when you make a request saying search for pizza. That's a request. And those are tiny little, you know, it's tiny pings, if you will, as opposed to downstream traffic, which is everything you get. So when you check your email, you make one little tiny request to the email server, but then you get this onslaught of 100 emails. That's a lot of data.
I'm surprised if email is included, that emails aren't a bigger chunk. I mean, I would think email requests would dwarf, frankly, either one of them.
Not the request, the delivery.
Well, the delivery of emails, I would think would dwarf. I check my email 100 times a day. I get like 500 emails a day. They have photos and stuff attached to them. And I know most emails are small, but it would just seem like with the billion people on the internet, you know, it just would seem like traffic would be a lot bigger.
It just goes to show you how data intensive and how heavy that YouTube and video traffic is, that Netflix traffic.
And look how poorly Amazon is doing. That's fascinating.
Yes. Well, that's why they're doing their original series.
Yeah. They want to get attention.
That's right.
Now, and maybe if their series is good, they'll get nominated for an Emmy.
That's true, because the Oscars remain the big kahuna of award shows. So maybe it's no surprise then that the Emmys are following in their wake. They just announced, the Emmys that is, that the TV award show nominating process will move gingerly into the online world. Next fall's shows will have online voting for the first round, and then in 2015, they'll use online voting for the entire process. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. Hopefully soon it'll come to presidential elections as well.
Well, I think it's a big deal for this reason. They learned. They said, hey, let's not do the whole process online. Let's just, you know, let's migrate. Good idea.
get learn how to do it right and then step forward. Yes.
Yeah. What is Mattel's biggest toy line, do you think, Michael? Is it Barbie?
Ah, of course, Barbie.
Well, in almost any previous year, you'd be right. And historically, nothing is bigger for Mattel in total sales than Barbie. But right now, the gold standard of Barbie has been exceeded by the disaffected teens of Monster High.
Launched Do your daughters collect them?
I hate these things. launched in 2010 and featuring teenage relatives of famous monsters, the kids include ghouls like Draculaura, the daughter of Count Dracula, and Frankie Stein, the daughter of Frankenstein's monster.
Why is she named after his dad's creator?
I don't know. It's been a monster hit.
Oh.
What, you didn't think I'd make that joke?
I know.
Please. Anyway, it's grossing more than $1.4 billion compared to Barbie's $1.3 billion. And of course, now it's being turned into a movie, as all popular toys have to be. I say, of course, it might have become a TV show on the CW just as easily. Instead, it's a live-action movie being overseen by TV talent Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage, the folks behind Gossip Girl, and the OC, among others. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I'll pass that to you, Sperling. Big deal or big whoop for your favorite toy line.
I'm sorry, there is no movie. I don't know what you're talking about, kids.
You're going to go see it. Do they love them? Do they have the dolls? What are they?
Yeah, they're like the most popular, the kids get the dolls when you know, they have a birthday. It's like, what do you get an 8-year-old? I don't know, get them one of those Monster High things.
So you get that, and then they get the houses, and you get the clothes, and you get the add-on accessories.
Yeah, thankfully, I've been able to kind of divert their attention away from Monster High. But to watch
Angelina Jolie blast people away in Tomb Raider?
Yeah, precisely. Put the monster doll down. I've got an Angelina Jolie movie I need you to see. It's called Girl Interrupted. Okay, now this is the woman from Tomb Raider, except now she's a little bit crazy, pill-popping, and she says some words that you probably shouldn't mention at school.
So Monster High was going to be a musical, but they seem to have changed direction. Now it's live action, straightforward comedy drama or whatever this might be. So we'll have to see. Certainly, you know, it's got a great fan base and, you know, whether you can turn it into a big movie is another deal.
That's true. Now, this next one is a big deal, so we should just skip it, right?
No.
Well, because in a decisive victory, Google won its book scanning case brought by the Authors Guild. Google had previously settled with major publishers over its ongoing project to scan every book, including many out-of-print and obscure titles found in libraries. Initially, they made little effort to determine if a book was in or out of copyright, for example, but their practices have changed. Nonetheless, the Authors Guild suit said Google was stealing books, not merely making snippets of them available for Googling and thus exposing them to a wider audience. They were actually stealing them, putting them under their jackets, and walking out of the store. The judge strongly backed Google in his final ruling. It advances the progress of the art, and this is a quote, it advances the progress of the arts and sciences while maintaining respectful consideration for the rights of authors and other creative individuals, and without adversely impacting rights of copyright holders. And this was said by Judge Denny Chin of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and he said it in his ruling on Google Books. It preserves books, he went on to say, in particular, out of print and old books that have been forgotten in the bowels of libraries, and it gives them new life. It facilitates access to books for print, disabled, and remote or underserved populations. It generates new audiences and creates new sources of income for authors and publishers. Indeed, all society benefits. My goodness, he was later hired by Google. Big deal or big whoop?
That's a big deal. I mean, his thing could have been written by Google. It is so... It's so laudatory. It's like it solves the problem of hunger. It ends, homelessness. It's amazing. But I agree with everything I have for years while we looked at this case. The idea that creating little snippets that you could, searchable and find like a sentence or two online that somehow that meant nobody was going to buy the book was just absurd. You know, and it always seemed like an idiotic case. You know, work with them to make sure they're not abusing copyright, get them to do better practices when they're deciding what to make searchable and all that. But, you know, work with them to see it as like this evil thing that they've wasted all these years on for. It was kind of a complete waste of money that they don't really have a lot of. So it was a very frustrating case. And I'm glad to hear the judge say basically what I felt all along.
Yeah. I mean, if you really want to see an interesting movie, a documentary about this, well, not only this case, but Google in general, try and look up Google and the World Brain. It's fascinating because it talks about how when Google went into France to try to digitize the French National Library, they brought a pen and a t-shirt and a mug, right? You know, to the head librarian, and he was like, "What? You think you can buy me with this pen? No." And kicked him out. He still tells that story.
Hilarious.
Well, not since Saturday Night Live, at its peak, has a TV series spun off stars like The Daily Show. The latest cast member to leave The Nest? Who is it? John Oliver, who guest hosted for Stewart when the boss was away making his directorial debut. HBO apparently woke up to the fact that Oliver was the breakout talent on The Daily Show, thanks to that. Don't they even watch it? I mean, don't you think? Anyway. And they have signed him to do a weekly satirical look at the news, politics, and current events, much like the UK's landmark series, That Was the Week That Was, or, as I like to say, much like the Comedy Central series, The Daily Show. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, that's what The Week That Was is. It has a much broader scope than politics, which is kind of the main thing of The Daily Show. It's a big whoop. We've seen it coming for 2 years now. Don Oliver's clearly been the guy that was ready to leave and go out on his own. The HBO quote, which is sort of what you're referring to in the piece, was so stupid. They're like, wow, we saw him guest hosting and realized we weren't even looking for a show, but what a fresh voice. And we're like, come on, he's been like the breakout guy on the show for 2 years. You tell me you didn't notice him until he guest hosted? And in fact, I thought he did a pretty crappy job guest hosting. So the idea that that was what suddenly woke them up to John Oliver, to me, is like ridiculous. But, you know, despite the, you know, he was doing The Daily Show, which was, he was stepping into John's shoes and having to mimic what was already there. He couldn't really go out on his own to make it fresh. We'll have to see how he does for HBO. It's a weekly series. It's much broader base than what The Daily Show is. So we'll have to see how they do. But, you know, good luck to him.
And, you know, the funny thing is the head of HBO was given The Office on DVD as a birthday present recently. And he really thinks this Steve Carell guy has a future.
Okay.
Of course, Steve Carell was on.
Don't spoil the joke.
Okay. Now, Michael, I know you have season tickets in the bleachers, or possibly the bleachers in the parking lot, I don't know, given how expensive tickets are, to the New York Yankees. So I'm sure you've already heard about this news story that I'm about to talk about. Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter is coming back next season after a frustrating series of injuries. He's ready to play baseball, but the 39-year-old is also looking ahead to his life after the Yankees, and apparently that includes book publishing. That's right. Yes. Jeter announced he would be launching an imprint with Simon & Schuster, and not one just focused on sports, either. He wants to publish fiction and nonfiction, business books and kids' books. Of course, like every celeb, Jeter says he'll be deeply involved. His name is on it, so he wants to sign off on the covers and the ads. Wait, ads for books? That doesn't happen. Bookstore campaigns? Wait, there are no bookstores anymore. And author signings? Well, okay, there are author signings. Heck, he's even going to be copy editing. Okay, actually, he won't be copy editing, but in any case, Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, obviously. A celebrity starts an imprint at a publishing house, but oh my gosh, you don't even understand. Derek Jeter never talks about like a week in advance. He will not talk to you about next week. He will talk to you about the game he just played and tomorrow's game. That's as far ahead as he looks. He never looks forward to the postseason. He never looks forward to the next season. He's always talking about just what happened today and what's going to happen tomorrow at the most. He never talks about the postseason or the next season. He never talks about his career after the Yankees. So it's very sad for me to hear him talking about life after the Yankees. This is the first time he said anything. And for him to say he's going to go into book publishing, I mean, he has two books. He has a book he published and a children's book spun off from that. I don't think he's ever even mentioned those. You know, I mean, he never talks about books.
Because that was yesterday. I did that yesterday. I don't talk about yesterday. Exactly. I talk about today. I mean, and today I did not write a book.
Occasionally he goes to the movies, and I'm pretty sure he goes to see like Avatar and Last Escape and Gaia movies. You know, he's not like he's talking about art films. To have him say he wants to go into book publishing, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I just can't believe it. I'm so astonished. I got more emails and phone calls like, oh, Derek Jeter. Now you can talk to Derek. Now you can have him on your website. Now he can invest in Book Filter. Blah, 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 blah. But I'm excited, but I can't believe it. I just wish I knew. I wish they'd said something like, well, what book are you reading right now? Or what's the last book you finished? I just want to know what the heck. He reads books. Not a lot of athletes do.
Playbooks.
Exactly.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Today, we're talking with author Anita Elbersee, the Lincoln Fine Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School, which, that's a mouthful, where she became one of the youngest female professors to be awarded tenure in the school's history. She is also the author of a fascinating new book titled Blockbusters: Hit-Making, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment, and it's out now on Henry Holt. Amazon just selected it as one of the best business books of 2013. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Variety, and Fortune. Anita Elbersee, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and apologies for that awful title. It's way too long.
Well, your book covers not just Hollywood movies per se, but TV and fashion and sports and music and nightclubs and other areas broadly considered entertainment. One thing is constant, though, throughout the whole book: the blockbuster is king.
So, yes, I think the book shows that it really is all about blockbusters, not just in Hollywood, but also in many other sectors of entertainment. And I look at music, at sports, at television, publishing. And if you look at the numbers, there is quite a bit to be gained from making these really big bets that we see all around us.
But maybe we should define what is a blockbuster. In your book, you kind of there's a very clear definition of what a blockbuster or a tentpole is.
Yeah, so I look at the strategy of making big investments, and I think you can define a blockbuster as an outcome, right? As something that's very successful. In the book, I look at it more as the input. So the idea is that if you have a portfolio, so say you're Warner Brothers and you release 20 or 25 films in a given year, what they do is they spend a disproportionate amount of their budget on a handful of, at most, of what they think are the most likely winners. So those are the blockbuster bets. And if you look at portfolios of other content producers, again, book publishers or record labels, the leading content producers tend to have that same strategy of making big bets on the most likely blockbusters.
It's sort of like playing the slot machines. You can play the penny slots from now until doomsday, but most you're ever going to make is maybe $100. But if you play the $5 slots, the $10 slots, your payoff may not be as big as far as the ratio is concerned, but it will be $100,000 or $500,000. And if you really want to get to those big numbers, you really have to place big bets, don't you?
That's an interesting analogy, I think, and I think that that is capturing the basic idea. And what was a key reason for me to write the book is that many people thought that with the advent of digital technology, with all these new online channels that we have at our disposal, that somehow we would see a democratization of markets. We would see that maybe these smaller niche products would actually find an audience and be safer investments. But in fact, what I show in the book is that as we go more digital, we in fact see that we'll have a world in which there'll be even bigger blockbusters and even bigger superstars. But I think that's a great analogy to make.
Well, I guess we should probably mention then George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. They said, look, Hollywood is making too many big bets. And this was earlier this year. They made this, they kind of gave their vision of the future. They believe that Hollywood is going to implode under all of these blockbusters, and that the entire business will change its ways, where films will be made that cost, you know, much, much less, and there'll be more of them across more filmmakers. And, you know, these are the two men who actually helped build tentpole movies, helped create them. What did you think when they said that?
Well, so, I mean, I think a lot has been made about those comments that they made. I've never been able to actually see in what context those comments were made. Right, so you can talk about an implosion, but I still don't know in which context they made those comments, and I haven't been able to track down any transcripts. So it's hard to read, I think, too much into them. But I think they expressed a level of discomfort with the types of material that Hollywood is churning out nowadays, and that's a very common concern. And what I actually found much more interesting were comments made by Steven Soderbergh a few months, I think, before Spielberg and Lucas made their comments, and he was, I think, making the exact same point, but also acknowledging in the same speech that he understood why this is happening and why Hollywood studio executives, along with executives in many other domains, are making these big bets and are making these requests of directors to be mindful of the fact that these films will need to make money at the box office. And that, I think, is actually a much more thoughtful way of looking at it. And maybe Lucas and Spielberg had the same idea. Yeah, so I'm always afraid to take a few quotes out of context, but I think if you look at what has happened since their comments were made, we're coming off of the most successful summer at the U.S. box office, and I think this is a year in which many people would agree we're seeing some really, really amazing films and critically acclaimed films that run across the spectrum of being relatively expensive. Or being very inexpensive. And so I think I'm actually relatively optimistic about the entertainment space. And I think making these big bets is an essential part of the overall strategy of making Hollywood have a more sound business model. And that benefits both bigger and smaller movies.
Well, I think what I really found interesting was that you say, yes, blockbuster bets are the smartest ones to make, but for various reasons. Not just the fact that it costs a lot of money to make these bets and you don't have an unlimited supply of money, but for a lot of reasons, it doesn't mean that the only bets a studio or a book publisher or a music industry label should do are massive blockbusters. For almost every category of entertainment, you want a mix of projects on your calendar. So there are some sports franchises that survive and flourish financially just by having superstar athletes, but most of the best ones, especially the ones that win, have a mix of superstars, homegrown talent, journeyman players. Most movie studios, they don't want just tentpole movies. You also want medium-sized prestige pictures and small bets on like horror films and young directors that you think might become the talent of the future. So if you're a book publisher, yes, you want your name brand authors, but you also want to make smaller bets on small authors that might become the name brand authors of the future.
This, for me, is actually a key element of the book, right? It's easy to just dismiss this book as saying something. Okay, there's a woman from Harvard that says we need to make more blockbusters. But I think it actually is much more nuanced. And I always give the example. In the book, I talk about a book publisher that makes virtually all its money from its top 10% of titles. But it still makes the 90% cheaper titles. And you have to ask yourself, why is that? Why does Warner Brothers put out 20 films in a given year when there are only 4 or 5 tentpole movies? Right. And why does a record label insist on making smaller bets too? And you have to realize that they play a key role in the portfolio, that they just play a different role. They're not necessarily there to be these guaranteed moneymakers. They could be R&D for these content producers going forward, or they could make sure that they maintain great relationships with partners in the channel, be it retailers or exhibitors or anyone else. So I think that is an element. The blockbuster strategy doesn't mean you only make blockbusters. The blockbuster strategy means you deliberately make a few really big bets, but you also make a number of smaller bets. And that, I think, is also why it's relatively healthy for the film industry to have that strategy.
Taking what you just said of having some smaller bets and some bigger bets, you talk about, you use soccer or football in Europe and the rest of the world, and you take Real Madrid and a couple of teams, and you point out how some of these teams operate, both on a blockbuster size, where they've got the David Beckhams of the world and these superstars, but they also, some of them, grow their talent at home. They have like a farm league, if you will, to bring talent through their own system. And in doing all this, you start talking about the talent lifecycle. Can you explain to listeners what this talent lifecycle is? I found this fascinating about how there is a cycle, much like a product lifecycle, to these superstars.
Yes, there certainly is a cycle to being a star, and you're right to make the comparison with the product lifecycle. So this is a relatively well understood concept that a product released by a company will go through a certain lifecycle. We'll have a startup phase, and then we'll reach some sort of level of maturity, and then we'll eventually become less useful to people, so we'll eventually die out in a way. And the key insight in the product lifecycle is this notion that a company that manages that product needs to make different decisions at different times, right? So what you do in the startup phase for a product, what strategies you have there, is very different from what you do if your product is maturing, for instance. And I think the same, so the book, I make the argument that the same can be applied to talent as well, because in many ways, talent are ingredients into the products that are being given to us as consumers. And there's a very distinct path to most careers. And if you, in the book, I present some data for soccer stars and tennis players and Hollywood movie stars. If you plot their activity across their age, you see that they tend to, the resulting curve tends to resemble a bit of a bell-shaped curve. For a soccer player, for instance, they tend to peak between age 24 and maybe 28, 29, and it goes downhill relatively fast after that. Now, the idea is that if you are managing that talent, or if you're that talent yourself, the kinds of decisions that you make across the life cycle will also have to differ. The kinds of risk you take early on in a career might be very different from the kinds of risks you take later in a career. And that has implications, for instance, for if you're an actor, what roles will you choose? Or if you're an athlete, what type of endorsements or what type of compensation models for those endorsements will you pursue?
And of course, there's the theory that a star, a movie star will wax and wane. Look at John Travolta, who was big in the 70s, kind of disappeared in the 80s, came back in the 90s. So I guess that's kind of the exception that proves the rule.
Yes, and I tend to think of George Clooney as another exception. I mean, he actually gets better looking by age, which is quite fascinating. Meryl Streep would be another exception to the rule in that she has enormous staying power. In the world of soccer, there's Ryan Giggs, who's still playing and at an extremely high level at age 40. So those exceptions make it quite interesting. But yeah, the vast majority of actors or of soccer players is around for only a very short period, is at the top of their profession for only a very short period.
Ironically, I would say as a soccer fan that I'm really just coming into my own in the 40s. My chanting, my clapping is a lot stronger now than it was in my 20s, but I guess that's a different issue. But I wanted to ask about books and music. I can understand why movies and television remain dominated by blockbusters, because individuals can't create a blockbuster movie. You can create a small indie film, but you cannot create the Avengers on a dime with a handheld camera. Same thing with a long-running television series with high production values. But to me, it seems like books and music might be more vulnerable to independent publishing and independent posting of music. Only big companies can make big tempo movies and TV shows, but books and music seem a lot more vulnerable to the democratization effect. But then when you look at something like the book 50 Shades of Grey or Justin Bieber, they both had tremendous success on their own. But when they wanted to take it to the next level and become blockbusters, they turned to a major established company. Isn't that right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you gave me an idea for my next book. I definitely have to look into your life cycle as a sports fan. This sounds fascinating. but you're absolutely right that these are really interesting trends we're seeing, particularly in music and books. Those are, as economists call them, simple creative goods, where it's sometimes it's just one person or it's a very small group of people coming together to produce something. And that is very different from films and television series, which are much more complex. And in the book, I describe these two trends, which I think is one of the more fascinating things that's happening in today's entertainment world. This notion that some people, some of the biggest stars nowadays can decide to go and offer their services directly to consumers. And I gave the example of Radiohead, a British band that decided in 2007 to sell its album In Rainbows directly to consumers. They had this innovative name your own price model, but what was much less, I think, understood is that they sold the album without the help of a label and without the help of a retailer. They just sold it on their own website. And Louis C.K., a comedian, is doing the exact same thing, or did the exact same thing with one of his comedy shows a while ago. So this is putting pressure on the existing system, right? These big established stars saying, I think I can do it alone, and leaving the companies that nurtured them at the moment when they become almost guaranteed moneymakers. And at the other end, we see, as you rightly pointed out, Justin Bieber or Amanda Hawking, which is one of today's most successful self-publishers, building up a fan base online and then going and joining the existing system. Justin Bieber sold with Universal Music. Amanda Hawking sold a three-book deal with St. Martin's Press, which is part of Macmillan. And that is also putting pressure on the existing system because, yeah, they're safer bets, but that comes at a price. So now St. Martin's Press and Universal Music are paying more because they are buying into proven talent. So those, I think, are really interesting trends to watch. And they certainly I think the implication is that there's more opportunities for individual stars or talented people otherwise to reach an audience directly and to really shape the career that they want to have.
Well, yeah, and you talk about, well, we were talking about Justin Bieber, but you have a case study of Lady Gaga and Jay-Z. Lady Gaga releasing her third album, Jay-Z releasing a book. And I mentioned these two together because they both wound up doing the same thing, which was partnerships, and not partnerships with other musicians or other authors, but partnerships with commercial brands, whether it was Microsoft in the case of Jay-Z, or, well, a plethora for Lady Gaga. I mean, I don't think it ended with Lady Gaga. It's almost mandatory now to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that is also a direct result of digital technology and the advent of digital channels. Because if you think about the book industry or the music industry, there are fewer opportunities now for these existing players to give us the products that we want in these traditional channels, right? There are fewer bookstores, there are fewer record music stores. So they, and this is still a primary way by which books and music is sold. And they bought on impulse, right? People walk into the store not knowing what they want, and they walk out with a truck full of books or their entire bag full of CDs. This still is a primary way by which people buy, but there are fewer opportunities to put that product in front of them. So I think what these Lady Gaga and Jay-Z and Taylor Swift and Beyonce and other of these megastars are discovering is that for them to do these kinds of really big blockbuster releases, they need a lot of money to pay for the kinds of big media campaigns that we've become used to. And they also need these additional channels through which they can make their products available. And then it helps to have these partnerships with big electronic companies or big consumer good companies in other fields. And Lady Gaga partnering with Best Buy and with Target and with a bunch of other retailers, that's not a coincidence, right? Those are designed to make sure that it's easy for us to buy. My favorite brand partnership is the one that Taylor Swift did with the Papa John's Pizza, where you could walk into a pizzeria by the time she had her album Red, and you could get a pizza and an album for $19. I mean, it may sound corny, but it's really smart to get around some of the problems of today's entertainment space.
Because there are no record stores left, so you got to get the CD to them somehow. Now, I don't want to criticize the cover of the book, but I thought maybe you should have put Adam Levine of Maroon 5 on the cover, because he seems like the luckiest guy in the world who's benefited from sort of innovative deals between indie and major labels and the big blockbuster bets that some TV networks have to do, like NBC. They reacted to the penny pitching ways of Jeff Zucker by turning around and saying, we got to make a big bet. We got to do something for our network. We're in fourth place. We're going to make a blockbuster bet on The Voice, which includes paying top dollars to some big stars like CeeLo Green, Christina Aguilera, and Adam Levine.
Yes, but he's also an example of someone who is quite typical, I think, for people that are trying to make it in the entertainment business, in that it took him a really long time, first with Kara's Flowers and then with Maroon 5 to reach that stardom. So I'd say he's among the people that really deserve some of the success that's coming to him at the moment.
Yeah, he's an overnight success, 10 years in the making.
Exactly, yeah. And in the book, I describe how Octone, the label that's behind Maroon 5, now A&M Octone, how they have formed this partnership with, at first, Sony and now with Universal, whereby they have this really interesting model, I think, that suits today's entertainment industry quite well, where they say, okay, we're going to do all the legwork in trying to make these artists catch on with audiences, and then the moment we see that we're getting the right kinds of sparks from the audience, we're going to turn to Universal, and they'll bring in their distribution and marketing resources to really make these things breakthrough hits. And that, I think, is Octone was one of the first, I think, to do that. But you see all types of partnerships in today's entertainment world.
On our show, we talk about the film figures every week for box office around the world. And one of the regular things we keep an eye on is the Met Metropolitan Opera, the Met Live in HD, and their broadcasts, which we don't get good figures for over the world, but we can see what they grossed in North America. Just for example, on Saturday, November 9th, a live broadcast of Puccini's Tosca in 800 North American theaters grossed $2.3 million. not a lot, of course, in context to a big Hollywood movie, but it's almost found money in a way for them based on their investment in the tools to make a broadcast like that. And of course, they make a lot more money over around the world. So it's a fascinating example of what they do. You describe it as a blockbuster bet because it was a major investment after the first season. It hadn't really paid off financially, but the Metropolitan Opera stuck with it. From my outsider point of view, I always thought it was a no-brainer because opera has a huge worldwide audience, but there's only a tiny theater in New York City. It has very few seats, very few performances, and very expensive tickets. So you've got millions of people who'd love to go, but even if they could afford it, they wouldn't all be able to go because there's only like 12 performances of a major opera. So, you know, it seemed to me like taking this and putting it into a movie theater and doing a live simulcast was sort of a no-brainer investment, but you describe it as more of a big gamble.
Well, I mean, I think looking back, it's easy to say, well, that was a no-brainer, but it certainly I think was a risky decision from the outset, right? It was it's relatively expensive to produce these HD live operas. I think at the time I did the case study, it was probably about $1.1 million, and that's just all variable cost. They're renting the equipment. So this is a relatively expensive endeavor for an opera company that, yes, has a at the time had a budget of over $200 million, but it was like a make or break every year of around $3 or $4 million. This is at the time that they were doing this in their first season, they actually, I think, lost $4.5 million. So to just add to that, and by losing a few million dollars or on something that tries to bring opera to the masses, as Peter Gelb, who is the general manager of the Metropolitan Opera, as he described it at the time, that is a pretty risky thing to do, to have to convince the donors that maybe instead of giving their money to these live productions, they should really give it to opera that can be seen in the theaters. But it has been quite a game changer in the world of opera. And I think it just makes it all the more courageous that they stuck with it. And it's sort of like the Monday Night Football version of opera. And it has created, I think, an entirely new market. And now this is a big source of income for the Met, precisely because, as you say, they're tapping into people that otherwise would not go to the Met, and because they're not in the area or because they don't have the means to go. It opens up these international markets. And I think what I find the most fascinating is that it creates this winner-take-all market for opera now. There always was this notion that some opera houses were better than others, but now the better opera houses really can command huge audiences. So the rich, in a way, will get richer. And what will happen to the smaller opera houses, I think, is still to be seen. You could argue that they benefit from the bigger exposure of opera. But you could also argue that they need to now differentiate. Otherwise, they're going to get snowed under by these fabulous offerings that the Met brings to theaters across the world.
Yeah, I believe Al Reese in the 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing talks about that, talks about how basically promote the vertical, promote the, if you're in soda pop and you're Pepsi instead of Coca-Cola, try and promote soda in general, because that actually helps more people drink soda. And I think your point here is, hey, if operas are being viewed, even if they're the Met, that the Kansas City Lyric Opera should benefit by the fact that people in Kansas on Saturday go see an opera at the movie theater. Maybe on Thursday night or next Friday night, they'll come to the Kansas City Lyric Opera. And you kind of mentioned the same thing in talking about Major League Baseball. What they did there was quite interesting.
Yes, I think the Major League Baseball is one of those other companies that has embraced digital technology and from the get-go said, how can we use digital technology to create a better experience for the fans? And then if you, I think, talk to today's baseball fans that are also watching Major League Baseball Advanced Media, which is its online arm, if they are using Major League Baseball Advanced Media's products, they are among the happiest sports consumers in the world. They can watch any game they want, whenever they wanted. They can get a whole bunch of statistics on top of that. And it's all reasonably priced. It's device agnostic, so it doesn't really matter what mobile phone provider they have or what mobile phone platform they're using. These are the types of products that are available to anyone. And for, I think, a reasonable fee. So BAM, Major League Baseball Advanced Media, or BAM as it's called, jumped on the opportunity to use digital technology to offer their fans a better experience. And I think the Major League Baseball as a whole, I think, is better for it as a result.
Well, but is it all a matter of scale? Because for Warner Brothers to make a big bet on, say, Harry Potter and to spend, I don't know, $500 million making The Hobbit, that to them is a lot of money. And that is a big bet to them. To Steven Soderbergh, who might be running a much smaller production company, spending $10 million on a film might be considered a big bet there, yet they can both make money at different scales. They, in other words, the Hobbit could make $1 billion or $1.5 billion, whereas Steven Soderbergh's $10 million movie, if it makes $50 million, is actually doing quite well. Or are you saying, look, the $10 million movie doesn't have a chance because the $500 million movie with its huge marketing and all of its tie-ins and partnerships will just suck all the air out of the room?
Oh, I mean, I wouldn't say it has no chance, but it has a much smaller chance of succeeding than those bigger movies, because it's competing for the same amount of attention at the same ticket price, and it's probably going to last as long, right? So, as a consumer, and most moviegoers don't go to the theater very often. Now, I have to choose: do I go to Steven Soderbergh's film if I've even heard about it, right? Because they probably had less of an advertising budget, so chances are I haven't heard about it. Or do I go see Iron Man 3? And so in that type of scenario, and you see this over and over again if you run the numbers, the chances of success for those smaller movies just tend to be lower. Doesn't mean that they can't succeed, and sometimes they do, and then those are the great success stories. But across the board, they have a lower chance of succeeding.
Right. And of course, since you wrote the book, we can see people putting into action all these sort of blockbuster bets that you talk about and different ways of reaching consumers. Lady Gaga launched a new EP or album, and she had a fashion event. She had a flying dress, quote unquote, that got a lot of attention. She had a sort of a dance party rave around a sculpture of Jeff Koons, which was used on the cover of her album. It was streamed on Vivo. So you can see how she's got all these partnerships and a way to reach people. And in the book world, we have a debut novel called City on Fire, which was highly touted, and 10 publishers were bidding on it, and it ended up winning a $2 million auction, which is a huge amount of money for a first novel by an unknown author. His name is Garth Risk Hallberg. It's about New York City. And so you can see how the trends of blockbuster bets continues in all these areas. And so I'm wondering, since you did all these case studies with your students, you developed this book, I want to know how you put it into action when you were negotiating your book with your publisher. What blockbuster terms did you extract from them? Did you, you know, did you talk to them about where they featured the book in the catalog, or how many pages it had, or the ad buy? You know, what was sort of did you try and apply any lessons you learned to what they were doing with this book?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think we had two rules. One was, if in doubt, always go for a flying dress. That was one that we put in place very early on. And then the second one was, if we want to have a blockbuster book, we need to make sure we're on Showbiz Sandbox. So those were the two main pillars, actually, of the approach that we had.
And then NPR would be second, and being chosen as one of the best business books of the year by Amazon would be second or third, I guess.
Yes, those were secondary objectives. It really was about Showbiz Sandbox more than anything else. Because, I mean, you and I both know that that's really the path to success.
Exactly.
Do you have a chance when the book is... I wondered about ebooks a little bit, because it's a book packed with facts and figures, and there might be some you want to update or tweak.
Although, I don't mean to interrupt you, Michael, I was actually surprised. You literally have facts and figures here that are from the summer, practically. I mean, you talk about Jennifer Lawrence winning Best Actress, and I thought, well, that just happened. Didn't the book have to be done by then? I mean, it was remarkable. So I'm sorry to interject, Michael, but I was pretty impressed.
So I wondered about updating in paperback and also on ebook. I wondered if publishers have adjusted yet, because it seems to me, especially with a nonfiction book filled with details, that there might be some tweaks you'd want to make or some little additions you might want to add, and whether you can like send out the ebook again to people that already said it, or at least refresh that for that when new buyers buy it, they'll get the newer version. Or do those possibilities present themselves yet? I know publishing's a little slow to adapt to new technology.
That's an interesting notion. I hadn't thought about that. We did try to make sure that the book was as up to date as possible. So up until the last deadline, we kept making sure that it contained the latest information. So that, I think, explains why Jennifer Lawrence made it into the book. Jay-Z's launch with Samsung came just too late. That's one of the biggest regrets, I think, because that falls within this notion of brand partnerships. But yeah, I mean, I think the goal is to write a book that is going to last a while. And I think these are principles that that are going to be applying to the entertainment industry as it evolves. So it's not supposed to be stuck at one time. But I certainly should give a thought as to how I can make sure that I keep updating readers on new developments. At the Harvard Business School, I continue to develop new cases. And so those are always for sale. So it's just a few dollars and readers can find out what the latest is. But following some of what I do on social media would, I think, be another way to get the latest insights and get them completely free.
So Harvard sells case studies online available for just the general public. Do you do it through Amazon or how do they purchase those?
We sell them on our own website, much like some of today's biggest stars do. So, yes.
And of course, everybody can follow you on Twitter. At Anita Elbersey is your Twitter handle. We will place that in the show notes.
Thank you. Yes, no, and the goal really is to develop many more case studies. I recently released a case study on Vogue, the fashion magazine, and there's a lot more exciting stuff coming down the pipeline. So maybe at some point I'll have enough material for Blockbusters, the sequel, but we'll see.
Well, of course, that would actually be very meta, but also that would actually be exactly what the book was saying, is that, you know, it would be a known entity, a known quantity, a successful book. And so you'd have to pay yourself more money.
Yes. I'm not sure if my publisher is convinced that, that they will need to pay me more money, but I can certainly pay myself more money. I think that would be very effective. Yes.
But now just, and in closing, you do these case studies and are they meant for presentation to a class or are they meant specifically to sell to the public or to other academia?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we produce these case studies as teaching tools. So first and foremost, they are documents that our students read before they come to class. And in fact, students across the globe read because instructors at other institutions very often use Harvard cases. So they're designed to put our students in the shoes of a Hollywood executive or someone who leads a record label or someone who manages Lady Gaga. And then they're supposed to foster a discussion or at least force them to think about what they would do if they were these people. So the case studies actually don't provide answers. They just raise questions. So what I do in the book is take some of the elements from these case studies and actually provide what I think are the answers, or provide background on how I look at these case studies. But no, they're first and foremost for use in the classroom. That's their primary use.
Well, Anita Elbersey, the Lincoln Filing Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School, and the author of Blockbusters: Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us and discuss your new book. It is out now on Henry Holt, and we will place a link to it in the show notes. It is a fascinating read.
Okay, bye-bye. Really appreciate it, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, bye.
Well, that was good of her to join us. A lot of interesting facts in the book and her take on the Hollywood industry. I have to say, I agree with quite a bit of it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely worth picking up. We will place a link to the book Blockbusters. Is it Blockbuster or Blockbusters? He says it's Blockbusters. Apparently there's more than one. It is plural, but you can pick up one book and read about all of them. Blockbusters by Anita Elbersey. We'll place a link to it in the show notes. We'll also place links to, well, all the stories we've discussed on today's episode in the show notes on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, or ways to follow us on Twitter, where our username is ShowbizSandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, where you can search for ShowbizSandbox and you'll find our page. Or you can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Now, I should mention, next week is Thanksgiving week. We will not have an episode next week.
Sperling's fault.
It is my fault. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show, it's by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or, of course, on their own website where they're probably selling their own music, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz has a website. Michael, it is?
michaelgiltz.com, and you can visit my book website, bookfilter.com, for more exciting book stuff.
Oh, there's no...
I couldn't think. My mind's a blank. I'm sick. I don't feel good. Getwellmichael.com. That's my website.
Okay. Well, until 2 weeks from now, play nice.